Talk given Friday, 20th February 1976. Let us start this evening by reminding ourselves that the real fulfillment of man consists in a complete transformation of one's mode of awareness of the world in which he lives, which includes, of course, himself as integral part and parcel of that world. Now, if this transformation of the mode of awareness is to take place, the most important point we have to bear in mind in connection with this is the exercise of attentiveness. Very broadly speaking, the problem of the religia involves two modes of awareness. One, the mode in which the 4,000 millions of the world function, the worldly mode of awareness of existence. And the other, which is the specific concern of anyone who desires to understand life, the purpose of his existence, and the way to fruition, is the transcendent mode of awareness. But it must be clearly understood that when I use the word transcendent in this context, it must not be thought of as something superhuman or away from us in the ordinary way, or something which is different from the worldly mode of awareness in the sense that it has no relationship whatsoever to the worldly mode. In a sense, it has no relationship because its quality is perfection. Its quality is not finite. It is the immeasurable. And in that sense, it is transcendent. But only in that sense. Otherwise, it is simply a case of so living, so understanding, and so growing to our fulfillment that the worldly mode of awareness is transformed into the transcendent mode of awareness. It's very important to understand this. Otherwise, in the deeps of the mind, in our subconscious or unconscious, we separate, permanently separate, the transcendent or the religious, if you like, on the one hand, from the worldly, the secular, on the other hand. And this is a mistake. As long as the mind holds this separation in terms of two irreconcilable opposites, we are everlastingly in a state of conflict, and a conflict which will only preserve our state of confusion and lack of understanding. It is very important to understand this very basic point, that it is the transformation, the transmutation, actually, of what is present here and now. our worldly mode of awareness into the perfect human, which is the divine mode of awareness. Don't separate human from divine. The two are an identity. And one of the loveliest ways, the simple human way in which it is put, occurs, of course, in the New Testament, when Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And they say, they answer that, "Oh, some say you are Elias, come back, you are this person or that person, etc." And Jesus then asks, "But whom do ye say that I am?" The intimate disciples. And Simon Peter says, "You are the living Christ." The implication being the Son of God. "I, the Son of Man, am the Son of God." And it is very, very important to appreciate this point. In the Upanishads, of course, we have the absolute identity of what they called Atma and Brahman emphasized. An identity without any separation whatsoever. And they went so far as to say that Brahman, the absolute all, identical with Atma also as the absolute all, includes everything that we, in our ordinary mode of consciousness, would like to separate from Brahman. Because the moment we consider the evil, the conflict, and so forth, which there is in the world, and we say that Brahman, the Supreme, is also that which we call evil, well, the mind boggles at it. How can that be? God, the ultimate, must be good. The person who says that is constantly forgetting that he is defining good in his limited terms. He is unable to take in totality into his own sphere of awareness. Because he cannot accept totality, therefore he tries to reject this and accept only that. And therefore he makes this mistake of separating the two out. A thing is evil, troublesome, only within a limited and a relative context. We as human beings, as ordinary human beings, of course, live in a relative context. Therefore, for us, there is definitely what we call good and evil. Now, the meaning of good and evil in reality is just this. Whatsoever releases each individual person into fruition and fulfillment, that is good. Whatsoever obstructs that life process by which such release takes place is evil. Hence it is that what we commonly call the vices and so forth are indeed evil things for us, because they obstruct this release into human fulfillment. When the release takes place, one's consciousness includes everything, what we commonly call everything else. One is no longer conscious in terms of otherness with respect to anyone, anything, any situation, It is not an other in the sense of not related to me or not fully related to me. The fact of the universe is simply this, that the countless particulars that make up the universe are in actual fact completely interrelated. But I, the human being, who am conscious in the way in which human beings are conscious, am unaware of the relationships, of the undeniability of these relationships, and of their factual existence as such. Now, when I, the person, the individual person, am utterly purified, this extraordinary transformation of my mode of awareness takes place, and I include everything. I reject nothing. I accept nothing as a separate thing to be rejected or accepted. In a peculiar, of course it is so, manner, everything is there, and I am in relationship with it, and it is in relationship with me. So that this transformation of the mode of consciousness brings about a radical change in my understanding of good and evil. Being no longer self-concerned or limited in my concern for any one person or thing or situation or whatever it may be. Being unconcerned that way, I am wholly concerned with totality as a cosmos. And therefore, there is no longer any conflict of good and evil, no longer any irreconcilable opposite. What happens then? I am in a state where being in right relationship with any situation, with any person, with everything, I can respond in the right way to that person, that thing, that situation. Therefore, there is an essential harmony which utterly transcends all concepts of harmony which I ordinarily hold. If we look into our own minds, we will see at once that our minds are full of ideas of ought to be's. This ought to be thus, this ought to be that thus, and that ought to be thus. But if I have such fixations in my mind, whatsoever does not fit in with that fixation necessarily produces conflict in my mind, and relationship is spoilt. It is clouded. I take sides with one aspect against another. The moment I do that, I am contributing to disharmony, not bringing about harmony. I cannot bring about harmony by predetermining the nature of the harmony, but by being so utterly selfless in my perception of what is, in that state of selflessness, the right relationship springs into being by itself. Now, let us take this question, therefore, of right attentiveness. What is it that spoils attentiveness, right attentiveness? All our biases our prejudices, our preconceptions, our assumptions. That's on the purely intellectual side. All are what are ordinarily classed as moral defects. And these, as well as the intellectual defects, are intimately tied up with our personal desires and our own personal conditioning. Our conditioning by the family in which we are born, by the social environment around us, by our education, upbringing, and so many other factors. Broadly, we are conditioned by the power of natural evolution and by the socio-cultural environment. The result is that the mind is filled with all kinds of ideas, beliefs, convictions, associated with all sorts of personal desires. Now, because we are attached to these, because we are not prepared to outgrow them, we fixate them in the mind. And it is the fixation which is the block, which is the obstruction to growth. If any part of my body, for instance, were to say, now, I have grown perfectly and I'm going to stay put, what will happen to me, the whole person? I shall fall ill. I shall be ill, won't I? Because it refuses to change. Let us say that it has the power to refuse to change. If it refuses to change, it means that the life process has ceased to function there. The life process means perpetual change. If that change is one which is in line with the harmonious functioning of the whole body, then that change is right and proper. If that change is taking place in a manner which obstructs the harmonious life process of the body, then there is illness, there is this dis-ease, and so forth. So now, this question of attention. We have already seen the intellectual aspects and the moral aspects, quite broadly speaking. How shall we attend, then? We attend through the use of our senses, don't we? By seeing things, by listening to things, by touching things, tasting things. We also attend through the process of what we commonly call study and the process of what we commonly call thinking carefully, which means talking silently in our own brains. Now, whilst we are doing this, our own mind is reacting back upon the impressions which reach the brain through the use of our sense organs and through the process of what we commonly call thinking. Now, watch those reactions. Those reactions, if we really follow them and understand them, will tell us just what we actually are. What is our actual nature? What are our personal problems? with regard to the purification of the psyche. If you don't like the word purification very much, what are the obstructions to the maturing of the mind? That means obstructions to the health of the mind. Obstructions, in other words, to our sanity. None of the criteria of the world are of any use where true sanity as a human being is concerned. The sane mind of a human being is a creative mind. Why? Because the very word human signifies the happy creator. Now be very careful here. The happy creator, the creative mind, in the context of religion, which is the context of transcendence, in the context of true humanity, is not to be confused with somebody who makes things, who produces things. Whether it be a philosophy or a great new idea which explains hundreds and hundreds of phenomena, like the scientist does, for instance, and so forth. It's not creative, particularly. The word creative is not to be restricted to that sphere. The word procreative applies here. As far as the ordinary man and woman in the world are concerned, whether that man or woman is a genius or not, whatsoever is produced by that person is a procreation. Everybody knows biological procreation, there is nothing to talk about there. But all the works of art, science, philosophy, etc., you see, all these are cultural procreations. I say this for the very simple reason that in our ordinary sphere, human sphere, if we have genius in art or science or philosophy or whatever it is, whatsoever we bring forth is related to something which went to all that which went before. It is not the absolutely new. It has its parents, its cultural parents. It has its cultural relatives, uncles and aunts and brothers and sisters and so forth. And so, strictly speaking, it is a cultural procreation. You see what I mean? But there is something other than that. The world as a whole doesn't know it yet. This other is of a transcendent nature altogether. It is non-repetitive. It shows no line of continuity from a past to points to a future. It doesn't do that. It is absolutely here now in the immediate infinity of the moment of time. And therefore it is of the nature of eternity. when the religious discipline of clear self-observation, especially of one's reactions from moment to moment to all the stimuli that come to our senses, when we have observed all that very carefully and we know ourselves, we are able to relinquish our grasp, our holding on to anything and everything that belongs to this becoming process in the universe. When there is no holding on to it, the manner in which you are attentive to this becoming process has undergone a complete transmutation. You attend in the split second, every split second, in the mode of eternity and not of a movement of time, a birth-death process. Admittedly, this is difficult to understand. One may think that, oh yes, he has put it so clearly that, I've got it. I haven't. But if somehow the psyche can be affected by it in a state of complete calm and passivity, which is absolutely alert at the same time, then you will suddenly experience this attentiveness which is in the mode of immortality, of eternity, of transcendence. And in that mode, you yourself are the instrument through which the creative activity of totality functions freely through you. The brain will never know how it functions. It will never know what this creative process has done. But that is the true and ultimate possible creative process for us humans. But you see the implications here. The purification which has been effected has released us totally from all bondage to selfness. And when there is the real freedom from all bondage to selfness in any and every form, this transformation, this transmutation of the mode of awareness has taken place. I say these things not with no intention to present a new philosophy or any such thing. A new philosophy is useless where the fruition of you, the living individual, is concerned. We do not come to fruition by philosophy or science or art or any technical process or disciplinary method or any such thing. All these assist, yes. They assist insofar as they awake us to the fact that nothing that they present to us or do for us must be grasped and held on to. Once we have ceased to grasp, then nirvana is manifest through you. Remember the first meaning of the word nirvana. It means the blowing out, the extinction, the blowing out of a fire, the fire of hate, of delusion, of ignorance, of fear, and so forth. So now, when this utter transformation of the mode of awareness has taken place, nirvana is manifest through you. But it is not a case of, I have attained nirvana, I've got home there, now I can stay there forever. I lock the door and say, here, you keep out. You're not fit to come. No, no such nonsense. But this wonderful thing called nirvana is manifest through you, and you don't know that it is manifesting through you at any moment. Nevertheless, it is the case that it is manifesting through you. This is the meaning of the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is within you. Look within, thou art Buddha. It's the same sort of teaching which you find in all the great religions of the world. All of them, without exception. But we have to understand it with the mind as free as possible from all the clutter of our ideas, our beliefs, our preconceptions, and so forth. Our beliefs and ideas and convictions are probably, all of them, true within certain limited contexts, in certain particular situations. But then, what is man evolving into as man, not merely as an animal organism? He is evolving out of finitude into infinity, into the absolute, into the immeasurable, the timeless. All these words include all that we know as finite and measurable and time and so forth. They include all that. But we are evolving out of this in terms of mind and consciousness. Of consciousness, not as just a set of thoughts. This is so important. It's very, very difficult to disentangle the two. We get an idea, a thought. Now, what I have said, after all, is just, in so many words, an idea. You can't escape that when you speak any language, or when you think for yourself, as we call it. You can never escape that. But so long as you recognize that this is what it actually is, this is not the truth in itself, this is the envelope which contains the letter, which contains the message. You see? So don't mistake the envelope for the message. It's like that. And therefore, if you do not grasp and remain watchful, rightly attentive, then this liberation process takes place. The purification of the heart and the mind takes place. And then you can rightly respond to each and every single person, circumstance, event, situation in the moment. Because you are living in eternity, in mind and consciousness, the immeasurable, the transcendent. And this is the state, this is the beatitude, which is the result, which is the inevitable consequence of having realized your true humanity. So then, just to sum up, right attentiveness, right responding, the complete transformation of your mode of awareness from the limited, confused, worldly state, the self-oriented state, freed from all that, into the unself state.